When you look at something made of steel, like a bridge or a railway line, there's this feeling that it's just done. It's static. It's permanent.
Right. It's the symbol of permanence, really. We trust it because we think it's not going to change.
Exactly. But today, we're going to pull that idea apart. We're doing a deep dive into what I'm starting to think of as the hidden lives of perlite. We're going to push it to the absolute limit. We'll see what happens when you heat it until it forgets what it is, crush it into something new, and even try to listen to it breaking down from the inside.
Yeah, and this is where metallurgy gets really fascinating. We're looking at a set of phenomena that researchers often just lump together as miscellaneous.
That sounds like a bit of an undersell.
It is. This isn't the stuff they put in the introduction of a textbook. This is the frontier. We're drawing on some really technical research here, looking at everything from, extreme heat treatments to ultrasonic testing.
So our mission today is to figure out how this everyday material behaves when you stop being nice to it. Let's start with heat. What happens when you just, crank up the temperature on a piece of perlite?
Well, it transforms. It doesn't just melt, it undergoes austenitization. That layered perlite structure turns into austenite.
A solid to solid change.
Right. But the geometry of how that happens is incredibly complex. The new phase, the austenite, has to kind of consume the old
I
one.
was looking at the notes on this, on where the new crystal actually starts to grow, and I came across this word, tetrahedron.
Yeah, that's a mouthful.
It sounds like something from a fantasy game. What is a 14-sided shape doing inside a piece of steel?
It's all about the modeling. See, if you're trying to predict how this transformation happens, you can't just treat the perlite colonies like little random blobs.
You need a consistent shape.
You need a shape that can stack together and fill a three-dimensional space perfectly. And mathematically, the most efficient shape for that is the tetrahedron, a truncated octahedron.
So, for the sake of the physics, we should picture the microscopic structure of steel as these perfectly stacked 14-sided blocks.
Exactly. And that geometry is key because it tells you where the austenite is going to be born.
It's not random.
No, not at all. It nucleates at the highest energy sites. So the corners of those little shapes or the boundaries where they meet other things, it starts in the corners and grows from there.
Okay, so it starts in the corners and grows inwards, but this has to be a process, right? It's not instant. It has to consume the ferrite and cementite layers.
Right. And that's what we call a diffusion-controlled process. Remember, perlite is a mix of carbon-rich cementite and carbon-poor ferrite.
And austenite is somewhere in the middle.
So all that carbon has to move, it's like a huge logistical problem at the atomic scale. The carbon has to get from the rich areas to the poor areas to average everything out.
It's a race against time.
It is. And here's the really interesting part. The speed of that growth depends entirely on how fast the carbon can move. But carbon moves way, way faster through ferrite than it does through austenite.
Wait, why is that?
It's the crystal structure. Ferrite has a more open lattice, a body-centered cubic structure. There's more room for the little carbon atoms to zip through.
And austenite?
Austenite is face-centered cubic. It's packed tighter. So as the new austenite phase grows, it actually slows down its own fuel supply.
That's amazing. So the growing interface is almost choking off the carbon it needs to keep growing.
You've got it. It's this complex atomic traffic jam right at the border. Now, that's if you're heating it at a normal rate. But the research also dives into what happens with rapid heating.
Right, the sources mentioned using electron beams or lasers, taking the steel up to 1200 degrees Celsius in, what, a single second?
And that just changes the game completely. When you heat and cool that fast, you're moving quicker than diffusion can keep up.
The atoms literally don't have time to move.
Exactly. If you do it slowly, the carbon spreads out nice and even. But at laser speeds, you basically freeze the chaos in place. You end up with what are called carbon gradients.
So even within one tiny crystal, you've got spots that are super rich, with carbon right next to spots that have almost none.
Yes. And then when you cool that down, the material gets a split personality. The carbon-rich areas might become hard, brittle martensite, and the carbon-poor areas turn back into soft ferrite.
A patchwork of hard and soft.
A very, very fine patchwork. And it creates enormous internal stress, which, depending on what you want, can be a good or a bad thing.
Speaking of split personalities, I want to jump to my favorite term from this entire deep dive.
I think I know which one.
Ghost perlite. Sounds like something made up, a campfire story for engineers.
But it's a very real and very useful phenomenon.
Okay, so what on earth is ghost perlite?
It's a material that chemically remembers what it used to be, even after you've destroyed the original structure.
How does that work?
It all starts with a specific alloy. You need a steel that's rich in manganese. The source uses one with about 3.7% manganese.
So manganese is the secret ingredient.
It's the ghost, yeah. When you first form the perlite, the manganese atoms, which are much bigger than carbon, they tend to hang out in the cementite layers. They segregate there.
They pick a side.
They do. Now, here's the trick. You take that steel, you heat it up to turn it into austenite, and then you quench it. You cool it down really, really fast.
And the manganese atoms are too slow to move.
Precisely. They're big and sluggish compared to carbon. The carbon atoms can zip around and even out, but the manganese gets stuck where the cementite used to be.
So you have the chemical footprint of the old structure, even though the structure itself is gone.
You get a material that looks perlitic. It has layers, but when you look closer, there's no cementite.
So what are the layers?
The dark layers are manganese-rich austenite, and the light layers are manganese-poor martensite. It's a ghost of the original.
And this ghost is actually useful.
Oh, incredibly useful. You get a material with a strength of around 2 gigapascals.
That's huge.
Yeah.
That's incredibly strong.
It is. But normally, steel that strong is brittle. It snaps. This ghost perlite still has about 11% elongation. It can stretch.
Why? What gives it that ductility?
It's those layers of retained austenite, the ghost layers. They give you something called the TRIP effect, or transformation-induced plasticity. When you put stress on the material, those layers absorb energy by transforming.
So it uses the memory of its old structure to be both strong and tough.
In a way, yes. It proves that the history of the material, the chemical segregation, can dictate its future properties even when the original phase is gone.
Okay, we've heated it, we've haunted it. Now I want to talk about just smashing it. The section on severe deformation.
Right. Moving from chemistry to pure brute force.
The sources talk about creating bulk nanostructured perlite. Now, the basic idea in metallurgy is that to make steel stronger, you make the grains, or in this case, the layers, smaller.
That's the Hall-Petch relationship. Yeah, the finer the spacing between the layers, the more boundaries you have. And those boundaries block dislocations from moving.
More roadblocks means more strength.
You got it.
And nanostructured means we're getting that spacing down to what? Like unbelievably small levels.
We're talking below 50 nanometers, maybe even 30. Your standard perlite might be 200 or 300 nanometers, so it's a huge reduction.
And some of the methods for doing this are just wild. The one that really caught my eye involved a massive magnet.
The 30 Tesla magnetic field experiment.
Just for context, a hospital MRI machine is maybe 3 Tesla. This is 10 times stronger. How can a magnet make the perlite layers thinner?
It's some really amazing thermodynamics. See, ferrite is ferromagnetic. It responds strongly to a magnetic field.
Right.
But cementite is paramagnetic. It pretty much ignores it. So by applying this huge magnetic field while the steel is transforming, you're tipping the energy scales.
You're making it more favorable for ferrite to form.
You're changing the Gibbs free energy. The magnetic field adds a huge driving force. The system wants to become ferrite so badly that it forces itself to organize much more quickly and finely than it would on its own.
That's incredible. You're using a magnetic force to physically squeeze the crystal structure as it forms.
That's a good way to think about it. But if you don't happen to have a 30 Tesla magnet in your garage.
And I do not.
You can just beat the steel into submission. That's the severe plastic deformation part. Things like ball milling or high-pressure torsion.
Ball milling sounds kind of simple.
It sounds simple, but it's incredibly violent. You put steel powder in a drum with heavy steel balls and just spin it at very high energy. You're constantly fracturing and cold welding the particles together.
And high-pressure torsion.
That's where you take a small disc of the steel, put it under a massive amount of pressure, gigapascals, and then you just twist it.
You're shearing the structure.
Exactly. You're mechanically smearing the perlite layers, aligning them and thinning them down from maybe 200 nanometers to just 20.
But there has to be a downside to torturing the material like that.
Well, there is. It gets super hard, very strong, but it also gets very brittle. It loses its ductility.
Yeah.
And because you've smeared everything in one direction, it's strong that way, but weak if you load it from the side.
Okay, so we can grow it fine with magnets or smash it fine. But then I read about something that just felt like arts and crafts. Artificial perlite.
I love this experiment. It's so clever.
They didn't grow it chemically. They literally built it.
They built it. They took thin discs of pure cementite and discs of low carbon iron, stacked them up, iron, cementite, and then basically squashed them together under heat and pressure.
And they made a layered structure that looks just like perlite, but huge.
Thousands of times bigger. The spacing wasn't in nanometers, it was in micrometers. You could almost see it with the naked eye.
So why? Why go to all that trouble?
Because it lets you isolate the variables. Hmm. When you study real perlite, it's so small, and the interface between the layers is so complex, it's hard to know exactly what's happening.
But with this giant version, you can measure everything.
You can physically test the bond between a single ferrite and cementite layer. You can see how a crack moves from one layer to the next on a scale that's easy to observe.
It's like building a giant Lego model of a molecule so you can see how it fits together.
That's the perfect analogy. It helps prove that the mechanical properties really do come from that layered structure itself, no matter what the scale is.
I love that. Such a brilliantly simple way to solve a really complex problem.
Yeah.
Okay, let's move from the lab to the workshop. Sooner or later, someone has to cut this stuff.
Right, machinability.
And the sources say something I found really counterintuitive. They talk about free machining steels and imply that soft, pure ferrite is actually awful to machine.
It is. It's terrible. Soft and gummy are often the same thing in metals. When you try to cut pure ferrite, it just kind of smears and sticks to your cutting tool.
It clogs up the works.
It literally welds itself to the tool. We call it a built-up edge. It creates a ton of heat and gives you a really bad surface finish. To cut metal cleanly, you actually want it to be a little bit brittle.
So the perlite, with its hard cementite layers, is already better.
It's much better. Those cementite layers act like tiny chip breakers. No. But to make it truly free machining, you do something that sounds wrong. You add impurities on purpose.
You add manganese sulfide. I thought sulfur in steel was the enemy.
In a structural beam for a building, absolutely, it makes it weak. But if you're making millions of tiny screws and speed is everything, you want those little particles of manganese sulfide.
Because they act as stress raisers. What does that mean?
Think about tearing a piece of plastic packaging. If it's perfect, it just stretches. But if you make a tiny little nick in the edge first,
it tears right open with no effort.
The manganese sulfide particles are those nicks. When the cutting tool hits the steel, the chip breaks off cleanly at those little inclusions.
So instead of a long, sharp, dangerous ribbon of metal flying off the machine,
you get small, manageable chips. It's safer, it's faster, and the sulfur even acts as a bit of a lubricant at the cutting edge.
So you sacrifice a little bit of ultimate strength for a huge gain in manufacturability.
It's all a trade-off. Engineering is always a trade-off.
Okay, we've heated it, smashed it, and cut it. What about looking inside it without breaking it? The last part of our source material covers ultrasonic testing.
Non-destructive testing, yeah. Sending sound waves through the material to find flaws.
And apparently, perlite is already what you'd call a noisy material.
It is, because it's so heterogeneous. You've got these alternating layers of soft ferrite and hard cementite. Every time the sound wave crosses one of those boundaries, a little bit of it scatters.
Like light in the fog.
Good analogy. The signal gets weaker. But the research points to a really clever way to use sound to detect very subtle damage, like the very beginning of spheroidization.
That's when the layers start to break down from heat and the nice flat plates turn into little round blobs.
Exactly. And your standard ultrasonic test, just measuring how loud the echo is, isn't sensitive enough to catch that early on. So researchers look at something else. They look at harmonics.
The nonlinear elastic coefficient. That sounds very complicated.
It does, but the idea is simple. Think of a perfect bell. You strike it, you get a pure tone. The material is vibrating linearly. But if the material has microscopic damage, if the crystal lattice is getting distorted, it doesn't vibrate evenly anymore. So when you send a pure sound wave in, the material itself distorts that wave.
It adds a buzz to it.
That's it. It creates new frequencies, like a second harmonic. It's like playing a clean note through a blown speaker. You hear the note, but you also hear a fuzzy distortion on top.
So they're not just listening for the sound. They're analyzing the quality of the sound to see if the steel is buzzing on the inside.
Correct. And that nonlinear coefficient, that buzz, turns out to be a much, much more sensitive detector of that early stage decay than just measuring the volume of the sound. You can hear the perlite start to fall apart.
That's incredible. We've gone from 14-sided shapes to manganese ghosts to building artificial steel like a sandwich, and now listening to its atomic structure.
It really just shows you that even a common material like this is an incredibly dynamic system. It's not static at all.
It definitely makes you look at a piece of rebar differently. It's not just a lump of metal. It's a frozen history of heat and force.
Absolutely. Every single grain has a story.
So here's a final thought for you to chew on. We talked about artificial perlite, building it mechanically, and we talked about using magnetic fields to force atoms into a certain arrangement. Right now, most metallurgy feels like gardening. We plant the seeds, the alloying elements, we provide the right environment with heat, and we hope the laws of physics grow the crystal structure we want.
That's a very fair analogy.
Yeah.
We create the conditions and let nature take its course.
But are we getting close to a future where we stop gardening and start building? Where we don't rely on diffusion, but we actually construct the microstructure we want, atom by atom, for the exact properties we need?
That's the dream of material science, isn't it? Designer matter. And if we can do it on a macro scale with disks and influence it on a nanoscale with magnets, well, maybe that future isn't so far away.
Something to think about. Thanks for listening to The Deep Dive.
See you next time.